There's no magic bullet in this market and, you know, building a firm or doing anything like that. And we've learned that over time. I mean, it's grinding. It's every day. But I do think about this all the time that, and I gave this example to somebody, you don't know the difference between the iPhone 15 and 16 or 14 and 15. But if you look at the iPhone 10 and the 16, you see a huge difference. And that's the same thing with companies, that sometimes you don't feel like you're moving ahead until you look back and you're like, oh my God, like 2 years ago, we were only 35 people. 2 years ago, we were here. 2 years ago, we didn't have this product. 2 years ago, like it's amazing. And so the day-to-day grind can feel, you know, sometimes really, really tough and you don't feel that progress, but it's happening.
Welcome to The Distribution by Juniper Square. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff. On today's episode, I sit down with Michael Episcope, co-founder and co-CEO of Origin Investments. Michael and his team have cracked the code on scaling a real estate investment business focused on providing access to non-institutional investors. As private markets become more accessible and more efficient, there are many lessons we can learn from Origin's success. We dig into the mechanics of supporting a large number of investors, the importance of technology and innovation as a differentiator, and how Origin thinks about investor education and client service. Let's get into it. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Brandon.
For our guests that don't know you, can you start by introducing yourself and your company, please?
I am co-CEO of Origin Investments, and my company, we are 100% multifamily investors. We have three strategies: we build, we buy, and we lend. And we operate primarily in Sunbelt markets. We've been in those markets for about the last 15 years. Origin was started back in 2007. I'm actually sitting in Chicago right now. This is our headquarters, but we don't invest here for many, many reasons. And we choose to invest where there's population growth, where there's job growth, places like that. And we have 65 employees, about 4,000 investment partners. So that's quite a few to manage. We obviously, Juniper Square helps us manage all those great partners. And then we have about 65 to 70 wealth managers who also invest with us on a regular basis. So we've been very fortunate, 17 years in the business about now. And my background really is non-traditional. I came out of the commodities trading world, a trader down at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange in my first career. My partner and I met about 6 years prior to that, and we were sharing investment ideas, and we kind of came together because the world was very different at that time. You didn't have podcasts like this. The Jobs Act hadn't happened. There wasn't as much transparency, and it always felt like it was two steps forward, one step back, or two steps forward and three steps back when it came to real estate investing. And you know, it's a great wealth creator. It's a great asset to generate passive income. And we just decided we could do it better. And we pooled our money together at that time, and it was more like a family office. We didn't have this grand vision, and it just grew organically over time, and it's been fantastic. And I went back and retooled, got a master's in real estate back in 06, 07. I was kind of, you know, interesting, the old man in class. I was with a bunch of young 20-year-olds, and I was like 35, 36, already done with my first career and learning about real estate. And what was cool about that is going back to school at that age is I was kind of the guy on the edge of my seat in every class. And, you know, even in the real estate law class, which most people found very boring, but I was raising my hand like 100 times. So it's been a great experience, and I'm blessed to have a great partner, and we have an incredible team and just a good story over the years.
Yeah, the story is incredible. And I want to get into that. You know, I've had the pleasure of knowing you and Origin for many years now. And I think it's a really unique story in terms of how you've built the machine that's enabled you to support 4,000 investors, your internal team, and then all of the deals and markets that you're in. But before we go there, you were at the Chicago Merc. Kind of, how did your professional career get started? Did you grow up in a business family? I'd like to understand a little bit more about kind of how you got started in the professional world, and then we'll talk about your on-ramp into real estate, passive real estate.
Yeah. Investing. Well, I'll tell you, I've always worked, and I don't, as a kid and stuff, I just loved working. And if there was a way to make money going to shovel sidewalks when it snowed, I always looked at opportunity out there. If it were, you know, something like mowing lawns, delivering papers, going to work with my grandfather, I just, you know, like I had a desire to work. And so when I went to college here in Chicago, after my freshman year, I got a summer job down at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and I loved it. I was a runner back then. I was making, I think, $330 per week working full time. I then pushed all my classes to night. And it's kind of weird, but at 19, I started my first career. And now I have kids who are 22 and 20, and they're still in college. And I was like, God, I was already 3 years into my career at that time. And that's kind of how it began. And I just kind of worked my way up and networked and did everything I could and did jobs I didn't like and figured out what I didn't want to do. And my art was always on the trading side. And when I finally got an opportunity to do that, I was well prepared. I did very well. I had 10 great years of trading. Computers came in. I was also at a different point in my life. When I started, I was single. I didn't have a nickel to my name. When I was done, I had accumulated some chips, put those on the table, but I was also married. I had two kids, another one on the way. And I said, I just don't want to risk this anymore because, I mean, every investing strategy has risk in it. But when you're dealing with commodity trading, you're talking about leveraging 300 to 1 on a daily basis and trading notional value of many, many, you know, tens of billions of dollars of interest rates every single day. So my thought process at that time was, look, I don't want to trade anymore. I don't want to take that kind of risk, but I do want to take my assets and have them work for me. I want to generate passive income. I want to grow my wealth, build my wealth. And real estate was kind of a natural choice back then. And so I went back to school, retooled. And I think some of this just got into my blood when I was younger. My grandfather was in real estate. I used to go and work for him on, you know, in the summers. And he worked on, I mean, tough stuff. West Side of Chicago, I'm sure some people know that, bought buildings in the 70s out of tax credit sales when you could, you know, pick up the tax certificate and then own the building 2 weeks later because nobody else wanted it. So he got his hands dirty. But I saw also the lifestyle that it afforded him and just the financial independence. So that's really what I wanted. It wasn't as simple as that. You know, we then started building a company, but it's been fantastic. And I wouldn't change anything. Life is never linear, you know, to success. And you take a lot of twists and turns, but it's been a fantastic journey. And that's kind of how I began and got to here, you know, probably missing a big part of that story. But that was my early days and how I started Origin.
And you mentioned you started it with a partner. And was this a partner that you met on the trading, like from your trading days, or somebody you had known previously?
No, somebody I'd known previously, but ironically, we both have very similar backgrounds. We both went to high school in Florida. He actually grew up there. We both come from divorced families, you know, working class families as well. And we just were kind of kindred spirits when we met at that time. And we both had the same need, which was, hey, our careers are over. What are we going to do next? We were already sharing investment ideas together. We were working on a nonprofit as well that he had started. And I came in as a board member and we hit it off. And, you know, that was it in the beginning. And so we decided to formalize it, sort of our investing strategy, by starting Origin and pooling our capital together. But at that time, it was like a family office. It was two guys buying real estate, and it's all we wanted to do. And we started by buying notes from banks. It was 07, 08. Our timing was pretty good. We were buying distressed deals. We're buying value add. We, you know, probably bought some stuff that we shouldn't have at that time. Just, it was a falling knife. We did fine on the other side, but you know, you look back and you're like, God, if I knew what I knew today, like about allocating capital and where I should have put my money instead of making, you know, 1.5x, you could have made 4 or 5x at that time on some of the deals that were available.
Before we get too much into the origin that exists today, I guess with the benefit of that hindsight, what is different from the reality of being in real estate versus the perception that maybe you anticipated when you were leaving your first career, entering your second stage?
I think the big thing was scalability. I didn't take that into account. And we were entrepreneurs. We knew what a great deal looked like. But the problem is when you're trying to grow a business, you have to think about how do you scale the business. And we were buying some condos and things like that, that, you know, at pennies on the dollar. But the problem when you're trying to buy, I'll give you an example. Down in Florida, we were negotiating with a credit union and we were buying single family homes for $65,000 a door. The problem was that we were using all cash. And we were buying these things. We couldn't get a loan. And real estate is a leverage game, and leverage enhances returns. And when you're all cash into an investment, it definitely reduces risk, but it also limits your upside. And at that time, that's at a time and point when you're buying things for 30 cents on the dollar and your cash flow is 10% cash on cash unlevered, you can afford to put some leverage on those particular deals. And we did that a couple times. And I think that's one thing that was really the aha moment. Hey, we need to find things that are financeable. We need to find things that are scalable in this business. And that's kind of what we did after the 08, 09 period and moved more into larger assets, value add in nature, and just things that where we could find either bank financing or GSE financing.
So I'm sure it wasn't a overnight success story, you know, many, you know, over a decade and a half in the making here. But once you decided to start Origin, it was you and your partner. It sounds like you were doing deals, you know, 07, 08, like you said, catching a falling knife. But kind of what was the evolution of Origin? Now that you know that scale matters, how did you think about kind of building this business, you know, step by step?
So it happened very organically, Brandon. Part of it was we started hiring people and internally, and we got an office and we formalized it into some that might sound funny, but we were literally working out of our homes in a small studio. But then as we hired people, you want to hire the best people you can, and the best people want to see growth, and then growth kind of feeds on itself. And so then you start raising outside capital because we had a decent amount of capital, but you realize quickly that when you bring on team members and employees, you need a larger pool of capital to amortize assets. And so then it became, okay, let's go find some of these deals. Let's put our money in, but also syndicate them, build the management fee side of the business. And so that was the early genesis of it. And in 2011, we started our first fund, Fund One, which went really, really well. We attracted outside investors. And to us at that time, there were two things that still guide us today, which is client service. You have to deliver on that, your reporting, your communication, everything. And then it was also about generating really great investment returns. And you did that. And we did that. And it was, then we jumped to Fund Two. That was like 2013. And we did very, very well. And then Fund Three was sort of our pivot point of investing, because as we hired these team members, they wanted to see more and more growth. And we wanted to grow. We're competitive people. You see your peers, how they're growing, and you're raising money, and you know you have a great product. But candidly, like David and I were not the institutional type. We didn't have the pedigrees. We came from a trading background. We had teams, team members who came from those types of backgrounds. And in some ways, looking back, it was the best thing that could have happened to us, because we had placement agents. We were talking to institutions. We weren't having any luck. And I just said, you know, to Dave, I go, look, I really think we should go all in on the high net worth market. And at that time, we were almost communicating to two different markets. Well, we don't want to say this because this could alienate the institutional market. We don't want to say this because, you know, we're having so much luck on the high net worth side. And candidly, I love the high net worth side because it's who we are. It's who we know. It's who we understand. And the goal and the vision has always been to build an institutional quality platform for the individual investor. In very few firms, most of them start with individuals, friends and family, then they outgrow them, they go to the institutional. And it really, you're almost serving two masters at that time. And that conversation really sparked us into saying, okay, you know what? We're not winning here. Let's go all in and take a path and take an angle and have conviction on it. And we did. And we used to be called Origin Capital. We changed our name to Origin Investments. We rebranded the website. We invested in technology. We invested in marketing for the very first time. And the premise was very simple. We have a great product. Let's put it in front of a lot more people and we will get more leads. And that's what we did. And we were sort of like, we got lumped into whole the crowdfunding. But the reality is it was just digital lead generation. That's all we were doing. We had our marketing team set up in a way to go out and advertise because we could at that time. And we were very early on. This was not a popular thing. And this is like 2015, 2016, and not a lot of firms were doing it back then. And our team was not on board either because they were like, oh my God, we're going to confuse the market. People aren't going to think we have money, this and that. And I think at that time it was Fundrise. They were really the only ones doing it. And we said, hey, guess what? We don't have money. So I don't know what we're doing here. And we did. And quickly, like they kind of got on board. And it was cool to see because they were like, oh my God, I met this guy and he loves what we're doing. I met this guy and he loves what we're doing and all the education. And so it was really a multiple pronged approach, but we went from, took us 7 years to get 80 investors, family offices along there. And then over the next 2 years, we grew to 500 in that time period. So the inflection point was amazing, but it was one of those aha moments. And we took a risk by, you know, zagging when other people were kind of going straight and doing the normal stuff.
When you were at that inflection point and looking to go all in with high net worth, kind of what were some of the pros and cons? I know it sounds like you are inclined to go high net worth, but what was a prevailing argument on the other side to kind of keep it more institutional or to keep these two buckets?
You know, it's kind of like we had pushback, but the reality was we didn't have a choice at that time. And I had full conviction that this was going to work. And that's, you know, I'll tell you, like I always tell even my kids, like I, even when I was trading and doing other stuff, I never looked at failure as like an option. It was just like, look, this can work. And it's a matter of execution and how well we do it. But you have to have 100% conviction and you can't be half in. And that's why we had the conversation about, look, if we're going to continue to try to please institutions and please high net worth, we're not going to make inroads and we need to pick a lane. And so like internally, it's going to be expensive. It's not going to work. It's this and that. You have your naysayers and you kind of push forward and you're like, I get it. So, but this is it. We have to go in this direction. And I think everybody's really happy today that we did this. And I think it, you know, when you're a first mover in the market, it makes a huge difference. And that's what we were.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing story. And I want to unpack it a little bit, but you know, I was telling you right before we started recording, it's fascinating to me because I split my time between talking to sponsors that are purely institutional and many that are subscale but non-institutional. And across the institutional sponsors that I speak to today, the number one thing that comes up in every conversation is accessing private wealth, aka non-institutional capital. Now, I think I heard you correctly. You have 4,000 investors. Is that correct?
Yeah, more than 4,000 today. We just crossed that mark about 2 months ago.
Wow. So how did you get there? I mean, you mentioned it was slow and then very fast, right? 80, it took you a long time. And then in 2 years, you got to 500. But from 500 to 4,000 is quite a journey. How do you think about kind of building that, you know, direct to investor, you know, funnel, if you will? You mentioned digital advertising. You mentioned it'll be expensive. I'm curious just to kind of unpack kind of what you've learned on this journey.
Yeah, it was interesting because if I take you back to kind of that 2015, 16, we were raising money for Fund 3 and all we had at that time were value add funds. And we had a closed-ended fund and when we closed it, I think at the, you know, somewhere in 2017, we had around 550 investors total in that fund. And the problem was in a closed-ended fund, and you know, it takes a couple of years to put that capital out. So we were still doing marketing. We had our team set up. We had the foundation and we were creating all these digital leads, but we had no product on the shelf. And we were just, you know, people were coming in, love you. Where do I invest? You can't, we don't have anything. They thought it was like a sales pitch at that time. And so we started to think about the business, what's good for the business. And then also what's a better wrapper, a product when you're dealing with only individual investors. I actually think that the market is broken investing in these buy, fix, sell strategies, because when you think about real estate, in order to get the benefits, the true benefits of real estate, you have to hold it and hold it for the long term. And if you want, you know, the cash flow and you want the depreciation, and you want the ability to refinance tax-free and future appreciation, you don't take a great asset, build some value, and then sell out of it and pay a bunch of taxes and never realize any of those benefits. And it was at that moment where like, look, this is actually good for our investors because we can take less risk and make more money. And it's good for our business model because now we will always have product on the shelf. And that was the evolution of our Income Plus Fund, which was right around 2018, 2019. It was on the tail end of when we were done investing in Fund 3. So then it was, okay, now we have a product that we believe is better for investors. We had to convince them, look, 9 to 11% is better than you chasing 15 to 17% IRRs, paying taxes, sitting in cash, taking all this risk, doing it over and over again. And that, you know, it's interesting because I think we were early on that front with the open-end fund, but now you see a lot of sponsors actually going to that because you have permanent capital as well. At that same time, we launched our Qualified Opportunity Zone Fund. That is only for individual investors. It's a tax advantage fund, so institutions would never go into that. And again, our job is to serve individuals. So when we're thinking about 1031, how do we serve them better? When we're thinking about other tax, QOZ, Income Plus, and then we layered on most recently our credit funds. And we started with multifamily credit fund about 3 years ago, and now we've designed strategic credit fund, which is exactly what it sounds. It's debt in multifamily and designed for the individual investor. So as tax efficient as you can be on the credit side, but I think our suite of products today are fantastic and all designed for the tax efficiency and thinking about the individual investor and how to solve problems in their life. If they need, you know, like myself, passive income to grow wealth, individual assets that maybe are development and don't have any cash flow for a couple of years, but have significant upside. And that's kind of how we thought and think today about building the platform. But I honestly think we're done like creating new products. And now it's just continually improving on what we have and improving the team and the platform and everything else we can do to just get a little bit better each and every day.
There's a lot of talk around the sophistication of the individual kind of non-institutional investor. And typically you hear that these people are allocating through wealth managers or RIA relationships. I think you mentioned you have many wealth managers who are also clients of yours on the platform. But how would you kind of describe a typical investor with Origin? Are they, you know, working professionals who have a tax event and need, you know, some, you know, more sophisticated financial planning? Because there's this kind of Wall Street versus Main Street narrative around the sophistication, the knowledge, the access. Do they understand? You know, obviously they understand what they're investing in, but is that, what does that enablement or education process look like for you to them?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'm sure you can imagine it runs the gamut. I mean, it spans, we have real estate professionals and a lot of people who are in the industry who invest with us. And then we have people who are first-time investors. And we think about the selling process or the sales process. It starts with education. And we have an IR team of 8 people, and they're there to schedule calls, make people understand exactly what they're getting into if they don't have any experience here, talk about the pros and cons and the benefits. But it's not a sale. And ultimately, people have to come and want to buy this and understand and see the benefits of these things. So we have everybody from, you know, first-time investors who have never been in real estate, never done an alternative investment, to attorneys who are reading and doing us favors, but reading every single line of the PPM and maybe pointing out some inconsistency. It's almost like free legal advice, and real estate professionals. So I think this notion that the individual investor is unsophisticated and you can go into this, that's not true at all. You have to assume that they are going to read through your PPM, that they are going to see every line. And there are investment forums out there where people share ideas. And there are people who are dedicated to just like going through all of these materials. And you as a sponsor, you can never have this gotcha moment, because everybody is looking for that. And you are in the business, we're in the business of building trust. And you want to build trust as quickly as you can. And what you say to people, whether that's your individual investor relations reps or you know, me on a webinar or anything like that, it has to be consistent. And we have that all the time. Like people are going through and thinking they got us on this gotcha moment. And we're like, no, this is how that works. And this is why it's in there. And I am always, you know, preaching that, like, you need to tell people exactly what they, you know, are asking about in everything, and just open the kimono there. Because the last thing you want is an investor who's coming and investing in a product where they're going to be there for 5 years, but you haven't set expectations, because that's where things go wrong, is where, you know, it is a partnership. And when two partners get together and expectations aren't clear about what we're responsible for, what we are going to deliver, and what, you know, what they think we're going to deliver on the other side, that's when things really go awry. So it's important for us to have that onboarding experience. And I can tell you, with all 4,000 of our investors, not one of them has invested with us without having at least a 30-minute to an hour call with somebody at Origin to talk about all the details of the funds and how we operate.
Yeah, I think this kind of Wall Street versus Main Street, you know, sophistication, myth is really that. And, you know, you've seen some of the big institutional players start to talk, you know, tap into the non-institutional channels like BREIT and others. But I think what you've built, really starting with the investor and expanding out based on reputation, is quite different. And when you look at your kind of portfolio today, I mean, what are some of the things that people may not appreciate when it comes to managing large numbers of sophisticated but individual investors versus the, you know, public pension plan who's writing you a check for $150 million? It's a very different model.
It's a different model. And I talked earlier a little bit about scalability. And when you go into this business, you know, sometimes success can have its own drawbacks. And we have 8 people in our investor relations group. We have another group of 9 people who are just in investor services, who keep track of everything in Juniper Square and the data and the information. And we have a big team for reporting. And for some, when you're dealing with a single investor, that communication, those relationships are going to be very, very different. But when we think about scaling, as we go from 4,000 to 6,000 to 10,000, we're going to probably have 20 people in our IR, because all of those people deserve a great experience. And if they have inquiries, you don't want like 2 or 3 people trying to do that. A, you're going to burn them out. B, response time is really, really important when it comes to client service. So you don't want to get back to somebody in a week or 2 or 3, or make them feel like, hey, you were really responsive when I came in, but now that I invest, I think the service is awful. And you can't afford that, because when you trip up once, it goes back to the internet is full of bloggers out there, people who are talking to one another, and we treat everybody like they're the center of influence. And that's what you need to do. But I think it's a different way to scale the organization, to be prepared for the amount of data and information and just juggling all these people. But candidly, the technology that exists today can help manage those relationships far more. There was nothing like this, you know, 10 years ago. We actually built a piece of technology when we first started in this business. We've since abandoned that because it's cheaper to rent than own that technology. But I think that gave us a huge leg up to be able to manage our investors early on in the business.
Yeah. When you think about the different types of structures that work for your investors, you mentioned you started deal by deal, you had a closed end fund, you talked about some of the challenges that presented. Now you have an open end vehicle. Is that, can you talk to me a little bit about that structure? Is that a perpetual vehicle with, you know, where you do valuations on a monthly, quarterly, annual basis, and investors can, you know, come in and come out like a traditional open-end fund? Or how does that structure work?
It's exactly what you said, Brian. It's an open-end fund. We have monthly distributions and also monthly times that people can get into the fund. And it's valued on a monthly basis as well. Obviously, we're not getting appraisals every month. You're doing those once a year. So what happens is the auditors, they actually approve your internal valuation methods, and then you corroborate those at the end of the year with appraisals, broker opinions, whatever is in your PPM. With us, it's appraisals. And then you obviously have to pass your audit as well during that period. So it's, in many ways, it's a complex structure to run. It's also difficult. You can have times where you don't have any cash in the fund, or times when you have a lot of cash that's in the fund and you're dealing with cash drag issues. So I do think it's the best way for investors to invest, because for us, we have the Income Plus Fund, which is sort of what I'll call our flagship real estate fund. We run all 3 of our strategies out there. We build, we buy, and we lend. So 20% of the fund is ground up development, and that is what I'll call the jet fuel of the fund. But those deals, once those are built, they migrate then into what I'll call the core plus bucket. And they're there for cash flow. They're there for depreciation, tax efficiency. We can continue to refinance those assets over and over and over tax-free, and appreciation. You want exposure to this market, and certainly the cities that we're in as well. On the other side of the coin, you've got debt, about 30, 40% of the fund today, actually more than that today. I won't get into that right now, is debt. And debt provides stability. It provides consistency, cash flow. And so those 3 together, you know, the nice thing about this fund, this goes back to our entrepreneurial nature, is that we can tilt that fund in any direction we want. So we've tilted it heavily towards debt in the last couple of years. But I was telling you before we went on today that about 2 months ago, we had a webinar to our investors, and we said, it's time to go on offense. And when we see things really like moving in the right direction in multifamily, we think there's going to be a leg up in the next kind of year. And that's corroborated by our machine learning model as well. But it is time to go on offense. And I think there's a lot of great things. Could be we be wrong? Yes. But I think as an investment manager, you can't worry so much about where you are today because we are in a recession. You have to be looking out 6 months or a year from now. That's when you need to place your bets, not when the market is running up and try to jump in. And I think when we saw this last, you know, sort of the peaks of the market, there was so much money coming in 20, you know, late 21, early 22, that was just kind of late to the game. So I think, you know, you have to be a little bit almost contrarian in a way, but, you know, place your bets before the market goes up, not when it's obvious, when it's already running.
And some of that must be dependent upon having the capital to do so, which means there's investor appetite. What are you seeing, you know, when you host these webinars and you follow up with investors from an interest perspective in taking advantage of, you know, what seem like, you know, generational vintage buying opportunities right now?
Yeah, it's good. So I'll take you back. Like at 22, capital was unbelievably plentiful during that time period, but the deals were what I'll call average. If you were in, you know, already placed your bets in 20, 21, and you were already invested in real estate, you did phenomenal through that period. Even if you rode it through, you're going to be just fine on the other side. But on the flip side of the coin, the deals today are better than I've ever seen them since I've been here, you know, in real estate, but capital is nowhere to be found. Now, capital, like going into a blind fund, is very difficult in today's market. But if you have a deal and a deal that speaks for itself, then you can find capital. And that speaks volume to investors because they want to be able to see and touch and feel what they're investing in. So even as recently, like we're going through this at Origin right now, we've got four incredible deals that we just tied up. And we don't have enough in our funds to actually capitalize all of these deals. So we're going to go out and syndicate them because we've never had a challenge bringing deals out to our investment partners. In fact, we have a, you know, basically a rule that says we will syndicate first to our investment partners and then go out to the rest of the world. 98% of the time, those deals have gotten gobbled up by our partners and been oversubscribed. So you have to get creative in times like this. And again, we've got a saying, great deals find capital. And it's so true that people can tell you, hey, I don't want to invest in real estate. But when you show them the right deal, they'll be like, yeah, I get it. That deal has incredible risk return characteristics. And in this environment today, I mean, it's phenomenal, especially on the debt side. And I'll tell you that the debt, you're being grossly overcompensated for risk on the debt side. Real estate values have come down 15%. You're lending 60, 65% as the senior lender. We're doing note on note loans and we're able to get, you know, mid to upper teen returns on one of the safest asset classes out there. And I just want to, you know, back up the truck on the credit side and the debt side because I've been in the markets a long time. And you know, as a manager, when you are absolutely being overcompensated for risk, and this is one of those times that you are because the banks have pulled out, you have high interest rates, you have a recovering asset class, but you have values that have come down significantly. So the new loan to value is so much different than the old loan. You're loaning to an asset that's declined at a better LTV and getting paid more. So I don't think it gets better than that.
So I want to talk a little bit about the assets, but before I do, I want to go back to one thing that you said. I think you mentioned your, what do you call your investors? Their investment, I forget the
partners.
Partners, yeah.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. Difference in nomenclature, your investment partners. I love that. And then you made the designation, you go to your partners, presumably these are people you've done business with for that have invested in previous vehicles. And then if you don't get a deal fully subscribed, you'll go out to the universe. Just because I know a lot of my listeners are institutional and they really don't understand this world, what does that mean when you go out to others? Like structurally, how does that work from a marketing perspective, a regulatory perspective? You know, is it like, you know, putting up banners on the internet or what is that? Just help give us a little bit of insight here because it seems very normal and natural to you. But as you know, a big part of the market operates under, you know, a different type of investor base today.
Yeah. And Brent, we operate 506C is what we're under. And so that allows you to market broadly to the universe. And there's really not much difference in when you're creating these LLC structures. But I think the advantage that we have is that we've been around since 2015, 2016 doing this. And we poured a tremendous amount of effort into content. and to create those leads in the organization. So while we only have 4,000 investors, we have a database and a marketing list of 80,000 investors, and none of that list has been bought. These are all people who have opted in, who have signed up. I'm sure a lot of those emails go into spam. People don't read them. But generally, when we have a deal, right, it starts with those 4,000 investors. And then once that happens, we have a running list of people who may have already raised their hand using Salesforce, using other technology, and we'll blast it out to them. And then it's done like that. So it's not, you know, if you don't have these relationships and you haven't kind of curated these lists, I would say don't ever buy a list. Those are a waste of money. Like, people have opted in to learn about Origin, to read our stuff. And it's so interesting to me because you meet people, God, I've been following you for, you know, 6 years and I just made my first investment. You have no idea who is in your ecosystem, who is actually engaging with you and consuming your content. Some of these could be students and some of these could be, you know, billionaires on the other hand, and they're just waiting for the right opportunity before they make an investment. So we've always been passionate about the content side, but that has really helped drive our database of potential investors now.
Fascinating. And you're not worried at all about giving away, you know, your competitive secrets or anything like that as you put a lot of this content out there for people to consume?
No, not at all. In fact, it's the opposite. I think when David and I got into this business, we saw so many, I don't know, just misgivings in them. I don't even know what the right word, but just we saw a market that needed more transparency and more education. And our mission is to enhance the lives of everyone in the Origin community. And we think about that, even people come to our website and they don't invest with us. If we can help them make smarter investment decisions and stay away from losses and do things, like, that's a win to me, because I've been in that seat before where I didn't really know what I was doing, you know, prior to Origin, made some bad investments. And I wish I had, you know, the resources to be able to make better investments. And we think about that when we're writing. And, you know, I've seen this happen to my mom firsthand as well, when she got into a 1031 exchange through an advisor who really, you know, was only interested in making his 7% commission and stuffed her into a really bad deal at that time. And you know, I think about people like her, and there's, you know, there's a lot of people who've worked very hard to earn their money, and it's really, really easy to lose it quickly. And I think the world, because of the transparency and because of the content that we've created and others have created, that you can't be a bad sponsor in this world anymore. You're just going to go to the wayside and you're going to be uncovered very, very quickly. Not to say that it can't happen, but it's less likely today. There's still some organizations who live under the, you know, non-transparent umbrellas that I'm not going to name, that I still can't believe they exist. But as long as there's the system out there where people are getting paid heavily to sell products, you're going to have those misincentives, or, you know, misaligned incentives.
And I know that, you know, there are, you know, with the RIAs that you work with, or the wealth advisors, I should say, I know that there's a lot of people there who are, you know, paid to help underwrite and evaluate. And then obviously you have your direct to investor model. You know, one thing you mentioned earlier is surprising, these like groups of people who are there to help, you know, talk about, or, you know, unpack the performance of sponsors. Is this like a cottage industry that exists where people are providing advice and directing, you know, their network to specific managers? I haven't heard of that before.
Yeah, there's actually quite a few investor groups, and they all exist for different reasons, but a lot of it is just putting wealthy people together who have had exits or have their own business or have some level of wealth, and they talk about different investment opportunities. Some of it, I mean, you've probably heard of Tiger 21. Tiger 21 is one of the, you know, most, you know, affluent groups out there. And then you've got other groups out there. And we work closely with Boulder Group, with White Coat Investor, with a new group that we've been speaking with called GoBundance. So there's a lot of these groups out there, and they do an amazing job of just helping each other with due diligence, underwriting, bringing good sponsors, asking the right questions. And within these groups, you have people of all sorts of backgrounds, real estate professionals, attorneys, and they do an incredible job of doing the due diligence and making sure that everybody is aware of what they're getting into going in, and deal flow too. So you're in there and you're competing against, you know, to even get a speaking engagement you're lucky enough to get that. But then it's, you know, you're in there competing against 10 other sponsors. So you better have something good to tell them and a way to differentiate as a sponsor.
So you've got your structure. Origin today, you mentioned about 60 people. Is that right?
Yeah, we're at 66 people, I think, right now. Yep.
And then how do you think about your exposure to the markets? Do you share your AUM stats or number of units or square footage or kind of what are the headline metrics that you use to describe the company?
Yeah, I use equity under management. That equity is ultimately what we get paid on. So we're just slightly below $2 billion in equity. And obviously you've leveraged that up and you're in debt and you're in common equity and ground up developments and things like that. But that's the metric that I care about more than anything as a company performance metric. And externally, what I care about are client service and returns. And those are the things that when you look at the long game, sometimes you have to actually turn equity away. And we've done that. Not, you know, even I'll give you an example. In our strategic credit fund right now, we have a queue. We have people waiting in line to get into the fund. We don't get paid on that money. We only get paid after they invest in the fund. But it's the right way to invest in the fund because otherwise all we're doing is people are investing in that fund and we're sitting on their cash and they're not paying us to put their cash in a bank account, but it also creates drag on your return. So instead of, you know, generating a 12% return in that fund, if we took the cash in, maybe we're generating a 9%. So you go from being, you know, a great return, double digits, almost, you know, kind of just below low teens to a very average return in those situations. So efficiency is a very, you know, like we are constantly finding ways to be more efficient, whether it's with our distribution channel where we're bypassing the broker dealers, going directly to the RIAs, or the way we operate, you know, internally, our funds, you know, just as I told you, or just making fast decisions and how do we gain an advantage over others in the market? And that's, you know, a constant evolution of ours.
And then, so you mentioned you're 100% multifamily, you build, you buy, and you lend. We talked a little bit about credit and we can come back to that, but I'm curious, you know, you told your investors a few months ago that it's time to, you know, it's time to get going again. It's time to start investing. The opportunities are here. So what are you seeing? Because there are some headlines around multifamily that are, you know, somewhat sketchy. I don't know the right phrase, but kind of unfavorable. But I think for our clients and people I know in the market, you know, it's certainly the headlines are very different than what they're seeing on the ground. So I'm curious to know what you're seeing and then kind of how you're thinking about the opportunity between now and, you know, call it the end of the year for the next 18 or 24 months.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing, and we are right now, we're in a recession. We are in the teeth of one of the biggest supply deliveries that we have ever seen. The reason why I'm saying that there's kind of light at the end of the tunnel is because in real estate, supply is very quantifiable. I can tell you exactly how many units are going to be delivered a year from now, a year and a half, two and a half years. It gets a little kind of blurrier 3 years from now because that's kind of the time frame that it takes to get a permit, put a shovel in the ground, and then deliver units. And so when we are looking out, we're in August, you know, of 2024 today. By this time next year, we will be completely through the supply and there's nothing on the other side. And we have seen incredible demand in the Sunbelt markets because that's where we invest, more so than, I mean, we could have predicted. Our machine learning was actually predicting this. And part of me was saying, I don't know, is it right? I can't believe this. Are we actually going to see rent growth? We saw negative rent growth last year, or negative growth in rents last year. This year, rents have actually been holding strong. And if you follow the public REIT markets, the multifamily REITs, and we do, 11 out of 13 posted positive earnings and had really an optimistic look. And we've also just had interest rates come down 60, 70 basis points. And the biggest thing, though, that's driving this is renting, as you know, some might say it's unaffordable. What's less affordable is owning a home. And the rent to own index, or owner's equivalent rent, I believe that's what it's called, index, it's never been more out of whack and favored renting ever in the history of the United States. Typically that index, you know, if you're going to buy, you're going to pay $200 to $300 more per month. There's tax savings, there's other reasons to buy. But if you're looking at the same today, that index is over $1,000 per month. And it's just driving people into apartments and creating incredible demand. And I would go on to say that the only way that this distortion in this index comes back in line is in two ways. You have housing prices fall,
which I don't see that happening. We've had 7% mortgages almost touching 8%, and nothing happened on the for sale side on that. Or you have rents rise, right, which is very likely, or you have interest rates decline, which is also a factor within housing. And rents rising and interest rates declining both benefit multifamily. And this is how I see, you know, this, what I'll call the distortion sort of coming back to a more normal level, because I do believe that there is, you know, you moderate more to the norm over time and these distortions don't last forever. So there's a lot of, you know, reasons. You know, we follow a guy, and I think anybody should follow Jay Parsons, because I think too many people get their headlines from, you know, papers who are in the business of just getting clicks and scaring people and things. And we've read so much about this avalanche of supply coming. It's here. And guess what? It's like a nothing burger.
The supply is the supply, but I think there's more demand than there is supply. Hence, it's a nothing burger.
Exactly. Yes. And you know, the thing about demand is it's impossible to measure. Like, supply is quantifiable, but demand is not. So we get here and everybody's got their fingers crossed. And I think it's greater than anybody could have hoped for at this time.
And you mentioned your machine learning model. Kind of tell me a little bit about what that is. There's obviously, you know, as you said, we're recording this in August of 2024. We're kind of 18 months into the AI boom, if you will. It sounds like you've got, you know, some models that you've been using for quite a while. And I'm curious, I'm always interested in understanding client and industry applications that are helping to make sponsors better investors.
Yeah. And this, Brandon, this is part of, I think, our innovative spirit. And you always scratch your own itch. And if we go back about maybe 5 or 6 years, we were renting the products that were available out there in the market. And we were banging our head on the wall because you would use these in your underwriting. You were paying, you know, a hefty price for these as well. And they would change them 6 months later. And you're like, well, had I known that, you know, we wouldn't have done this deal or something, you know, and it just didn't make sense. You're better off just throwing 3% rent growth in there and saving the money on whatever these were. And when you ask them for their data and their back testing and all this, they would never give it to you. It was a black box because the reality is they didn't have it. These were probably people in a room just taking a guess. I mean, maybe I'm being hard on them, but we had a terrible experience. So we threw a Hail Mary at this and we're like, look, there's got to be a better way. And we ended up hiring two data scientists from the University of Chicago, which also happens to be one of the premier data science schools in the entire world. And in some ways, we got lucky. We didn't know if this was going to work, but we said, hey, you know, let's get our people together and take what's in your head and try to put it into a computer. And that's the best world, right? Even in the trading world. And I remember a friend of mine saying this a long time ago. He said, look, have you ever thought about, you know, going into algorithmic trading? I said, no, it's not really what I do. He said, let me tell you something. Anything you can think, I can program a computer to do. And that's the same thing what we're doing is we're like, okay, what drives investment performance? What do we think is our theories about rent growth and all this? And what are all the limiting factors? And then they take billions and billions of pieces of data. And this has been layered on over a long time, but they continue to regress. What is the correlation here? How does it fit into the model? And it's all done by spatial data. It's a little over my head. I know when I talk to these people and we backtest and we look at it, there's nothing that's more accurate in the market. And we're proud of what we've built, but it was really out of that need that we needed to build it. And again, I actually think this is going to improve the world because our competitors have been calling our data scientists and trying to hire them away. So, you know, you're kind of nudging them and, you know, poking the bear there a little bit. And it's been a big advantage for us too, to know where the next markets are going to be, because if you're late to the game, it's too late. And we were early in Colorado Springs. We were there when dirt was $25 a square foot. It was $150 three, 4 years later. We were in Jacksonville before others. So it points us to the right markets earlier than others. And we just ran our biannual market evaluation and it, you know, kind of ranks all the markets based on a number of different variables. But we're proud of it, of what we built. And it's certainly a huge advantage to our strategy and ultimately ends up with better returns, which is why we put money and invest in it.
Is it a trust but verify kind of situation? I mean, has it ever spit out anything that's not intuitive or just seems, I mean, you mentioned some of the rent, you know, some of the rent growth or the demand metrics that it was spitting out 18 months ago were kind of not even believable, but obviously, and with the benefit of hindsight, it prove that they were right? I mean, how often are you kind of at odds? Is your intuition at odds with the model's predictions, if you will?
Yeah, that's a good. I'm a skeptic by nature. So I know that there is no way to forecast the future with real accuracy because there's too many variables. I've been a student of the market since I was 20 years old, watched these things. And, you know, in 2019, it wasn't exactly predicting COVID, you know, when we were early on. So there's just exogenous shocks that you can never, you know, predict in those situations and things that happen on other sides of the world that the model could never pick up. But it was interesting because we were early on, and I think they'd been working for us for about a year, and we were going into 2020 and COVID had just hit and their models were running and things like that. And it was about May or June, and the models started really like going kind of haywire to the point where our data scientists were like, oh my God, like we just spent a year and we created something that doesn't work. This is broken. Rent doesn't do this. And they were literally looking out a year and showing rent growth in some of our markets that was going to be up 14, 15, 17%. They never even told us because they thought the model was broken. And they kept going in and looking at the numbers and the data and regressing and finding new things. And it turns out, I mean, they literally didn't show us. No, no, we can't show you. We can't show you. And then the market starts taking out. And they were absolutely right on this. And they were actually, you know, the model was the first to predict negative rent growth in 2023. And we did that, you know, early in 2022. And this is all verified. Everybody else was calling for positive rent growth for 2023, 2, 3, 4, 5% during that period. And then it was like, 9 months later, they got on board. Hey, rent growth is going to be negative. It's too late by that time. And everybody who's underwriting and using models and stuff, you know, they're like, okay, I guess I'm holding this deal for another 2 years. You know, doesn't really help you to have information, you know, when you can see it right in front of your face. So, but the same thing that's happening today is it's predicting, you know, kind of stable rent growth throughout 2024. And then it's going to pick up in early to mid 2025 on that side.
I don't know how much you want to give away in a public forum like this, but any insights that you could share other than the rent growth metric that you just shared for 2025 in terms of places that, you know, folks should be looking, whether you're an investor looking to, you know, get allocation to a sponsor in a specific market, or, you know, maybe you're a sponsor and looking to understand what markets are hot or what aren't that are on your radar.
It's not even about giving away the secret sauce. It comes down to a deal. So I wouldn't want people to go, hey, you know, like, I'll just make it up. Like Salt Lake City is off the, you know, but if you overpay for a deal in Salt Lake City, you haven't actually, you know, you could end up losing money or the wrong deal. So it's about, I think the advantage of our firm is that deal flow from the day we built this firm, it's always been about seeing as many deals as we can and having our tentacles out there. So being in the markets at all time and tying up these deals and finding edge in the individual deal. So whether that's in Las Vegas or San Antonio or Dallas-Fort Worth or those areas and being able to move very quickly. But there's no, I wouldn't want people to use this data and then run out there because there's no index for, you know, if you said Dallas or something like that. So, but, you know, we don't, this stuff isn't a secret. We actually do publish these things, our mid-market review, and you can go to our website and see a lot of this stuff as well.
So one of the things that I really respect about the business that you've built, and it's a word that you've used many times today, which is scale. Not a lot of professional real estate investors start their business thinking about scale. And I'm a part of a lot of these conversations with our clients and others in the market where they get to a certain point and they hit this kind of terminal value where they're like, oh my gosh, I got to $1 billion in investor equity doing it this way, but I don't have line of sight to $2 billion or $5 billion or $10 billion, or I don't have line of sight to my next deal or my next hire, whatever it might be. I'm curious to know how you think about the value of the enterprise, not the dollar value, but like what is a durable business? And then maybe if you could touch on, there was some news recently, I think there's a strategic transaction that took place where you brought in a partner or sold a piece of the business or whatever it is. Maybe you can just talk a little bit about how that fits into this idea of building or creating a valuable enterprise and not just a promote stream or, you know, a better deal machine or a better investor acquisitions tool.
Yeah, if I take it to the corporate side, I mean, a lot, we think about everything in terms of risk management. And even at the corporate level, it's really, really important for us, and it should be for other firms too, that if the lights go off tomorrow, can you continue to pay the bills? And we used to track our recurring and revenue and our recurring expenses in this line, it was always the recurring expenses were above the line. And David and I had an advantage because we had wealth coming in and we always invested ahead of growth and thing, you know, for many, many years, but it was never to the point where if the lights shut off, we couldn't pay the bills and do that. So we've always thought about, okay, well, how do we build a firm that is sustainable, that can last for the long run? And part of getting away from buy, fix, sell was, look, we're on this hamster wheel where the, you know, AUM of the company goes up and then you sell all the assets and they go down. And so, you know, I was going back, I was telling you about the Income Plus Fund. Well, that's not only good for the company, but it's also better for the investor and the way they invest as well. And when you can have an open-ended fund with permanent capital and recurring revenue to pay your employees, invest in the infrastructure, that's a good thing. It's a good thing for us and it's a good thing for investors because they want a company that can last through times like this. Let's be honest. I mean, and there's some companies that didn't last over the last couple of years and may not last, you know, even going forward. So when I'm thinking about like scaling the organization and the enterprise value, I mean, it comes down to, and we went through a whole investment banking process. So a lot of this I learned, but how stable is your revenue? That's the first thing. How much of your revenue is coming from transaction fees? How much revenue is coming from your management fees? How much of your revenue is coming from your performance fees? And I'll just tell you right now, like if you're thinking about enterprise value, people don't pay you for performance fees. Those are almost kind of a throw-in, like you'll have them, but the reality is they don't equate into the multiple and they do a little bit, I guess, you know, because maybe the multiples on, you know, firms like ours are a little bit higher, but what they really want is that stable income stream. And that's really how BREIT is built too, is that's the value that it provides to Blackstone is in the management fee and maybe a little bit in the performance fee. So it's just about a trade-off between those two. But, you know, I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, I think so. And then there was a transaction, right? I don't want to speak out of school. What was the kind of basis for thinking about bringing in a partner to the business?
So we did have a transaction and the transaction happened at the end of 2022. And it really, you know, David and I have been talking about this for a long time because when you're running a firm for 15, 16 years, you're like, hey, where are we going? What's the end goal here? How do we continue to build this and find growth and find new opportunities? And you also find as an individual, man, this is a big piece of my balance sheet now. You know, how do I monetize some of this? So we went out, we hired an investment banker and we ended up shopping it around. But the reality was that the group we ended up choosing, they were one of the reasons why we even started in the first place, because they had approached us 2 years prior. And they are an RIA. They're here in Chicago. Their name is Kovitz Investment Group. And I didn't really understand much about their structure, but I've known their president for over 10 years. I know him. I know his co-president as well. I know the owners of the firm. They've invested in Origin as well. And we just like them, you know, from a cultural standpoint as well. But what they gave us was access also not only to their clients, but the broader Focus network. And Focus Financial Partners is an RIA, Registered Investment Advisor aggregator, with today they have over $400 billion in assets under management. So we saw it as a way, look, if we do this transaction, A, our team stays intact. B, you know, we can tap into this larger resource of capital. And the last thing was they really leave us alone. So they let us run our business. There weren't these synergies. When we talked to a lot of groups out there, they were looking at dismantling us and doing things. And we really, you know, our investors were concerned when we did this transaction. And many said, look, if you would have done the deal with PE, I would have been out of here. And we realized that because PE is very different. But, you know, being with an RIA and somebody who has a very long time frame, they're not interested in 2-3 year results. And by the way, they've been absolutely fantastic during these last couple of years. And they understand, they're in the same business. They see what's going on in real estate. And when you buy a company and you don't meet your business objectives in the first year or two, you expect that there's going to be some very difficult conversations. And they're like, look, you guys are doing great. We understand this business. We bought a great company at a good price and we're here for the long run. And we know that we're going to do, you know, all make a lot of money together. And that feels good. You know, you chose the right partner, because I do have friends who sold PE, and I'm not going to say this about all PE out there, but they're not having the same experience.
on the last minute or two that we have left, I'm curious, as you look, we talked a little bit about kind of what you're seeing based on your model and your intuition in the markets. But if we take a slightly different bend on that and we think about kind of the future of kind of broadening access to alternatives, broadening access to private wealth, kind of what are you most excited about over the next, call it, decade? I know that's a long time to think about. We can even break it down, maybe call it 3 to 5 years. Kind of how do you think things are going to either stay the same, or what do you think will be different as we move forward and more people are getting the experience of having access to alternatives or access to private real estate like you offer at Origin?
Wow, there's a lot there. What am I most excited about? Are you asking just in general about the market or at Origin, or?
I just think your business model, right? I mean, you've been in business for 17-ish years now. You know, you built up a better mousetrap than a lot of other people. And as you look forward to the next decade, you know, what are you most excited about?
Brandon, me personally, I mean, I think we're at a point right now where we have an incredible team, and we're going to continue to build infrastructure and just improve. And one of our core values at Origin is continuous improvement. So I said earlier in the podcast that we have, you know, of the four products that we currently have offered, we don't have any design to actually bring out new products. So it's just going to be a constant refining of the products we have and improving them and just making Origin into the best company it can possibly be. And that's hiring new people, expanding the platform, getting better every day at what we do. There's no magic bullet in this market and, you know, building a firm or doing anything like that. And we've learned that over time. I mean, it's grinding. It's every day. But I do think about this all the time, that, and I gave this example to somebody, you don't know the difference between the iPhone 15 and 16 or 14 and 15. But if you look at the iPhone 10 and the 16, you see a huge difference. And that's the same thing with companies, that sometimes you don't feel like you're moving ahead until you look back and you're like, oh my God, like 2 years ago, we were only 35 people. 2 years ago, we were here. 2 years ago, we didn't have this product. 2 years ago, like it's amazing. And so the day-to-day grind can feel, you know, sometimes really, really tough, and you don't feel that progress, but it's happening. And that's, I'm just excited about just continuing to realize the potential of Origin and seeing, you know, putting out some great products and having more and more people invest with us.
Excellent. And if people want to learn more about Origin, they want to get in touch with you or a member of your team, what's the best way for them to do that?
OriginInvestments.com. And you can email me. I mean, one of the things, Michael@OriginInvestments.com. So we pride ourselves at being accessible to our investment partners, sponsors, things of that nature. So communication's a big thing. And I think that's what you get. And, you know, even I call us a smaller real estate investment firm. I compare us to Blackstone, but, you know, we've come a long way, but we still want to stay true to our roots.
Awesome, Michael. Well, I've enjoyed our conversation. I appreciate you joining me and look forward to the next time we get to connect.
Thank you for having me, Brandon. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter @B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.